Hey there, everybody. Quick note about this week's episode. I'm digging deep into my bag of tricks here and pulling out one of my favorites from the vaults this week for a few reasons, the most important of which is, well, I need a little downtime after the insanity that was the last 4 weeks of travel, film festivals, planning, all that fun, really boring stuff you don't want to hear about. And I just needed a little bit of time off. And so what you're going to hear for the first time in the main feed is a Patreon bonus episode Scott and I recorded way back in 2021. And it's an interview with the one and only Michael Whalen. Whalen is a prolific fantasy and sci-fi artist who has done a few King things, but most importantly, he provided the paintings for the very first and very last Dark Tower books. We talk a lot about that with him, talk about his love of audiobooks, and mostly just geek out about Dark Tower shit for an hour. Because of that, I do have to warn you that we talk spoilers quite a bit, especially about Book 7, which is the very end of the road. So, if you're still on the road to the Dark Tower and haven't quite reached the end yet, I'd recommend avoiding this. Unless you don't give a shit about spoilers, then listen away, because we do talk quite a bit about some late in the game story elements here. So I hope you enjoy it, but before we get to Scott and I talking to Mr. Whalen, I do have a sponsor or two to tell you about, starting with the masters of microdosing, yes, Lumi Labs. If you're stressed out or your mind likes to run a million miles a minute, then you might want to give Lumi gummies a try. They offer indica, sativa, and hybrid gummies that are designed to be taken in smaller doses to maintain a level of calm throughout the day. Or if you just want the pleasant sensation of getting a little bit stoned, you can take a few more and you're good to go. I won't tell you how to use these Lumi gummies. It's safe to say that Lumi Labs is the longest sponsor we've ever had here at the KingCast, and I can personally vouch for their quality as they've helped me personally fight off insomnia and that dreaded vampiric sleep schedule that my body loves to default to. And the best part is you can get them sent straight to your door no matter what the marijuana laws are where you live. So check out microdose.com and see their wares. And if you decide to pick something up, make sure to use the code KingCast at checkout to get 30% off and get free shipping. That lets them know their ads worked, helps the show, and you get a nifty discount in the process. That's microdose.com, code KingCast. And that just leaves Fangoria. And you know Fangoria, they've been at it for over 40 years, and they are better than ever. The magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door 4 times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. If you use the code KingCast at checkout, you will save a whopping 25% off of your subscription. So that's Fangoria.com, code KingCast. Save 25% and get some greatness sent to you 4 times a year. With all that said, let's get on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Bedlam!
Bedlam! You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
I'm Scott Wampler.
And we are your hosts. Today we have a very special bonus episode with a guest I'm ridiculously excited to talk to. He is an artist, an illustrator, a multiple Hugo Award winner. Like, we're talking like 15, right? I think.
Yeah. Last time I counted. Yeah.
we'll ask you where you keep him in a second. He has shaped the way entire generations have pictured the many possible worlds of science fiction and fantasy. His work has graced the covers and interior pages of all-timers like Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, Harlan Ellison, Arthur C. Clarke, Robert Heinlein, H.P. Lovecraft, Edgar Rice Burroughs. I'm a particular fan of the Barsoom covers that you've done. Yeah. And of course, a guy by the name of Stephen King. You know we're huge Dark Tower nerds here, so it is with great pleasure that I introduce our guest, one of the two men most directly responsible for my obsession with Midworld. When I close my eyes and picture Roland's world, what I see looks exactly like this man's work. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the KingCast stage the great Michael Whalen.
Hey, thank you. I'm really, really pleased to be invited here.
Oh, man. We're thrilled to have you. This is a real honor.
One of the great things about doing what I do is that while I'm painting or doing whatever I'm doing, I listen to a lot of music and a lot of podcasts, a lot of audiobooks, which I hope we'll get into and talk about. And the KingCast has been a revelation for me and really enjoyable because I'm as much a King nerd as either of you two, for sure. And, you know, it's been a pleasure to be part of that universe, but to have people actually be interested in my experience in that is you know, really gratifying. So well, thanks.
You played a key role in, you know, as Eric noted in that intro, a key role in the way all of us picture Midworld. I imagine the full weight of that didn't occur to you as you were originally working on these things.
No, but it's a, it really feels like a heavy responsibility now, to be honest. It,
yeah, but you didn't screw it up. You
well,
killed it.
I hope so, not.
I think someone would have told you by now if you did, but it seems like, you know, for sure, you're doing great.
As I'm sitting here talking to you guys, I'm staring at one of your pieces. I have a print that you sold from your store of the Gunslinger on the Beach.
Yeah.
And it's been framed on my wall, you know, for a good long time. In fact, my one time that I got to meet Stephen King himself and I interviewed him, you know, way back in the day, I brought along this piece and I'm like, listen, at the end of the interview, I'm like, I don't really, you know, I'm not an autograph hound. I don't, you know, do that too much, unprofessional, blah, 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 blah. But at the end, I'm like, Dark Tower means a lot to me. Would you mind signing this? And so I have your piece. He kind of messed it up a little bit because he wrote his big name right, you know, right in the middle of the art. But, you know, we'll forgive him for that. But, you know, each and every one of these episodes we record, I'm, you know, my default like stare is just kind of looking at the sunset that Roland's looking at. So just in a weird way, you're not only have you shaped my fandom for this thing that I've been part of my identity, I guess, in a weird way since I was in middle school, you know, reading these books. Mm-hmm. You know, during each episode of this, you know, I'm kind of abstractly, you know, getting lost in your art. So anytime you hear me trail off and lose my thoughts, it's all your fault. Because I'm just getting lost in your work.
The greatest compliment to me when I do illustrations for an author's writing is if the author himself wants to own the artwork.
Yeah.
And Steve owns a good deal of the artwork I did for the both books. And so it says to me that I'm accurately conveying what he had in his mind when he wrote the scene or whatever. And you know, there's no compliment greater than that. So it's, he's got, several of my paintings hanging in his offices and places like that. So, it's, yeah, terrific. So
you're saying King himself probably stares off into this sunset while he's working. So we share that in common.
Yeah.
So we typically ask our guests their Stephen King origin stories and, it might be a silly question to ask you, but I know that you worked on a Firestarter limited edition before Dark Tower. Yeah. Was that the first time you'd heard of King or the first time you read King or
yeah,
were you a fan already?
Yeah, I think it was the first time. You know, I've been doing covers for the Doll Book Company's Year's Best Horror Stories for years. Mm-hmm. It was my favorite assignment every year. And, King had stories, obviously, in those collections from 1975 on. So I'm sure I was aware of his writing because I was illustrating the cover of that book, but never thought that I'd actually get a commission to do a cover to a book only of his stories. I think Firestarter was the first one that I became acquainted with. After I read Firestarter, I went and read everything available that he had written up to that point, and you know, Carrie and whatever, the Dead Zone or whatever else was out and available, and have been a fan of his ever since.
Tell me about for Firestarter, you just did the cover, right? That wasn't like the Dark Tower where there were multiple illustrations.
No, just a cover, you know.
Right.
That came about, I think, as a result of Steve and I were both guests of honor at the 1979 World Fantasy Convention in Providence that year. And I remember sitting on the dais with him. We were sitting next to each other and goofing around with the platters that they serve the dessert in. When you put one on top of the other, it looked like the flying saucers in an old 50s science fiction movie called Earth versus the Flying Saucers. And we were making flying saucers and screwing around up there and making ourselves laugh. And that was the first time I met him and got to hang out with him. And I saw he was like, just like me, you know, a warped guy. We're close to being the same age. So we grew up reading the same EC comic books and watching the same horror movies and reading a lot of the same books. And we're fans of Richard Matheson and people like that. So a lot of our formative influences were identical, you know, so there's many points of contact, you know, between his upbringing and mine. So the Toastmaster at that convention was a writer named Charles L. Grant. Mm-hmm. And after that convention, shortly after that convention, I got a call from the a publisher who was publishing a collection of stories by Charles L. Grant called Tales from the Night Side. And that was the first assignment I had coming up in the year, in the winter of 1980-1981. And I did that, and I think that may have led to them coming back to me for the cover for Firestarter. And It was the cover of Firestarter that King saw and liked a lot. And when the Grant Publishing people were about to publish the Gunslinger book, they asked him who he wanted to do the artwork for that. And he selected me on the basis of what I did for the Firestarter book. So.
And history was made.
Did he give you a heads up on that? Like, I'm gonna recommend you for this job, or did you find out through them?
They contacted me and they said, "We're publishing this Stephen King book, and he asked if you'd be willing to do the illustrations for it." And I said, "Sure," but I hadn't read any of the Gunslinger stories in Fantasy and Science Fiction magazine, so I had no idea what I was getting into, but. The timing was terrible because that was a really stressful winter for me. In November, my daughter was born, and being a new parent, you know, is very time consuming. You lose a lot of sleep and all that kind of stuff. And then in December, John Lennon got shot and killed. Two close friends of the family were killed in a car accident on I-95 here on the East Coast. And, I can't remember what else happened, but it was just a really shitty winter in terms of not having any sleep and having all this tragedy around us. So the last thing I felt like doing was a cover to a collection of horror stories. But the painting I did for the Charles L. Grant book came out really good. And when Firestarter came along, I jumped into it with both feet. I really liked the book a lot. Yeah. Identified with the lead character a lot, and I thought it was a terrific novel, and was really excited to get a chance to do something so different from the other books that I'd done book covers for. So it turned out to be a net really positive experience for me.
Yeah, well, it kind of makes sense when you kind of look at, you know, all the authors whose work you've, you know, illustrated, because that you would get this Dark Tower thing and be so associated with it, because there's so much DNA of all these people who you've already illustrated and brought, yeah. brought their work to life. Like within this, like that's the great thing about the Dark Tower is that it's an everything in the kitchen sink story. You know, it's a Western.
Yeah,
it's a
you know, I kind of think of the Dark Tower series as King's White Album. You know, if you, yep. if you think of the Beatles White Album, it's got everything in it from, you know, so many diverse influences are reflected in the songs. The changes in mood from one song to another are just totally off the wall. And the Dark Tower series is like that, though I had less of a hint of that in that just doing the work for the first book. I didn't realize until I got into the second and the third book, just, you know, how all over the map he was going to go with this thing.
Right.
really.
But even that first book has that weird like metaphysical confrontation at the end. Like it's not the pulpy thing you think you're getting into when you read it at the beginning, because it's like, you know, it opens so strongly with the man in black fled across the desert and the gunslinger followed, and you're like, okay, I know what story this is. And then by the time you get to the end, and it's, you know, there is no shootout. It is, you know, it is just like a battle of the minds, essentially, you know, between.
Yeah. And the canvas goes from this guy crossing this desert to the whole universe, you know.
Right. hanging on a droplet of water on a blade of grass. Yeah.
Yeah. It's mind blowing. It's truly mind blowing. So.
Yeah. No, I love it. So when you got this assignment, you agreed to do this. Was it known from the beginning that they wanted multiple pieces throughout the book, you know, or was that something that developed?
Yeah, no, they did. And I hadn't done that before. So it was a new thing for me. And I was excited about doing the idea of doing an illustrated book for adults.
Right.
You know, which is a rare thing, or was up to that point. When you thought of books that had interior illustrations, it was usually kids' books, you know, The Missing Piece by Shel Silverstein or something like that.
Right.
You know? So for a book for adults that had color illustrations inside was kind of a new thing and really challenging for me. But, you know, I enjoyed the story so much. I was totally lost in it while I was working on it.
Well, I remember I read the trade paperbacks. That was my introduction to it, which had your illustrations.
That's one that came out in 88?
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Same. And I am going to admit something for the first time on this podcast, in that since I was, I think, 12 when I picked it up, what I did was I saw the cover and then I noticed you can see on the binding, like, or on the outside, you know, where the little lines are, where there's the illustrations. Right. And so, and I'm like, okay. And I started flipping through it. And so I was like, am I going to read this book, was essentially my thought. I was reading all of Stephen King at that time. I love Stephen King, but I could give a shit about Westerns. And I thought,
me too.
What this was. And so, I'm like, I see the cover and I'm like, okay, this Stephen King and the names and his font, the big, whatever. And I'm like, all right, I flip through and I see like the Toll, you know, art that you did. And I'm like, okay, this is what I expect it to be. It's a badass with guns that are, you know, and there's a trail of bodies.
Yeah.
And
then bodies all over through the place, man.
Yeah. And I'm like, okay, this is cool. It's violent. I could probably get into this.
Yeah.
And I flipped through and I looked at all the pieces of art before I started reading the book. So, and by the time I got to the Slow Mutants piece, which is the cover of the Grant edition, and there's monsters pulling at a child as the gunslinger's firing at it, I was just like, okay, I think this book might be for me.
Yeah.
And then that's actually when I stopped and started reading. So.
Yeah. Weren't those Slow Mutants cool? I mean, I just love those guys. I could do 20 paintings of Slow Mutants, you know, that whole scene is just. Oh,
terrifying.
Man. Just awesome.
And I think that's my favorite of the illustrations in that book.
Mm.
Like, well, it is just imprinted permanently in my mind.
The idea of doing a scene lit by the flash of a gun.
Yeah.
Bullet being fired. I thought was, wow, I don't know if anyone's ever done that before, you know? So that was such a challenge. And even though the Slow Mutants themselves glow in the dark and all that, I thought the idea of having that being the source of light, there's some kind of metaphorical comment in there also, that the firing of a bullet defines Roland's character and his purpose and the universe and all that kind of stuff also.
So it all
kind of fit together like pieces of a puzzle. It just seems so right.
It really captures the claustrophobia of that sequence, I think.
Yeah.
You know, the claustrophobia of them just being, you know, traveling through the mountain on the cart. But that moment where they're getting swarmed, it's a terrifying moment in the book. And then you just nailed it. Like, it looks like ripped out of my mind's eye for that illustration. I'm curious if on further Dark Tower trades, were you flipping ahead to look at the pictures before you picked them up, or were you letting them come as you read the book?
At that point, I was hooked. So my memory is that I saved each illustration going ahead as a treat, but I don't know if I started that immediately, maybe with Wastelands, because I think drawing of the three, I did the same thing where I flipped to the art I saw. And because I have a memory of missing one. There's one that I missed, and so it was like finding a $20 bill in my pocket when I got to it.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I typically don't do that. I'm not the guy that likes to jump ahead, but I was doing weird shit like that when I was reading in middle and high school. Like I read a lot of Crichton at that time too.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but I just decided I would read the last sentence of his book before I started writing. And I don't like, I want to like smack my younger self for doing it, but I only did it with Michael Crichton, and I only did it in like a 1 year period. I have no idea why I got it in my head to do that, but
like from When Harry Met Sally, like, cause Billy Crystal in that movie, like his thing is he reads the last page of every book.
That's
he reads.
Right. That's right.
Just in case
that's
he
awful.
Dies
that's
beforehand.
Awful. Nobody should do that.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where you got the idea. That's all I'm saying.
Maybe. I was a huge Meg Ryan fan when I was in middle school. So,
good Lord.
I didn't mean it dirty. I was trying to make a joke. Damn it. Look at you. You're making me all blush and stuff now. So I'm curious about.
Sorry, Meg, if you're listening to this episode.
Yeah. And please come on the KingCast. So
yes.
So I'd like to, I don't mean to jump right to the final illustration, but I can tell you that the first book in the Dark Tower series was, you know, a great experience to read. I, you know, as difficult as it might be to jump in, like kind of, you know, the deep end for some people with that, that's part of the reason why I was so immersed in this. In the series, but that final image of Roland on the beach to me is everything that the Dark Tower is. It's the beauty, the darkness, the obsession, the hope, the mystery, the exhaustion, like all of it is in that image for me. So that to me is the keystone image of the series. Did you know you were going to end it on this image when you read through the book? Did they tell you they wanted certain, you know, images here?
Oh, no, was it nobody, all, what did you nobody art directed me at all, which was really great. I can't remember how that came about. I read the book and that was an image that was in the movie in my mind, you know? So
right.
I had a problem with the tower itself. And this is something we may talk about later, but King changes his view of what the fucking tower looks like from one book to another. And it drove me crazy, you know, that at the seventh book, all of a sudden it's this boring, dumb tower that's kind of short and doesn't have anything cool looking about it. And so, you know, I just came up with something that I thought looked kind of strange and a little science fiction-y and whatever. And it's, you know, you could tell that the book was going to be continued and go on and have other things happening. So I just, I don't know, I just went with the feeling. But I can tell you one thing, when my wife found out that I had just sold the painting on a whim and for a fraction of what I could have gotten for it, she was so pissed. That was her favorite painting out of the series. And boom, you know, I just kind of, you know, it's just, I can do another one, whatever. And
but you sold it to King, right? So that was the...
When I did the artwork for the series, I had no idea of how it was going to be used or what was going to be on the cover or... You know, I left that all up to the publisher. And I think if I had a plan in mind, it might have affected what I ended up doing, you know, for the whole package, you know, of the book. But I didn't. So I can't really claim that it was planned or that I saw that as being the penultimate image of the expression of the entire book in one image.
I have a question. Yeah. You know, you've already touched on this a little bit, the way the Dark Tower changes over the course of your illustrations of it, you know, the tower itself. And when I look at that, I'm looking at it right now, that image of Roland on the beach with the tower, it's, you know, it's notched. It has those cool, like, spires coming out of it, like at weird angles and maybe platforms or like, you know, when I look at that, it fires my imagination to where I'm my mind is trying to come up with what the functionality of the tower is. Like, why would that be there? What does this do? And so there's like a headcanon that goes along with it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm curious if you have a headcanon for...
Yeah, I did. And in my first version of the cover I did for the anthology called Legends, that had the painting of Roland stepping through a doorway kind of and a big tower in the background. My vision of the tower is that it would be this incredibly complex conglomeration of every architectural style existing on Earth. So you'd see a bit of the Taj Mahal or Buckingham Palace or the Reichstag or, you know, the White House and the Eiffel Tower and, you know, all the different expressions of humanity and architecturally, some Japanese or Cambodian architecture. Mm-hmm. It'd be all in there and all kind of fused and mixed together in an organic kind of way, representing the chaos, you know, of human development through time. But all I could hint at, you know, in that illustration was a silhouette that suggested an asymmetrical conglomeration. So, you know, there's weird bits going this way and that way, but I didn't try to define any of that. And I did when I did the cover in 98 or whenever it was that Legends book came out, but I decided that was too specific. And I went in and repainted the whole thing and made it more of a blur and more of a unreadable silhouette again on that image, because I didn't know where King was going to go with the thing. So I kind of copped out.
I'm endlessly fascinated by like the platforms that are extending off of it.
Yeah.
You know, I always end up like zeroing in on those and sort of like, I wonder what goes on those platforms.
I didn't know myself. It was just to represent a feeling, you know, a random chaotic design element.
That's a fascinating answer.
Well, for me, it's the spiky stuff at the top. You know, like, I just love, you know, I love it. And you're right. I think King got a little bit too literal with his concept of the tower being the linchpin of the universe and making it just like a big cylindrical, like Leaning Tower of Pisa.
He referred too much, I think, to the Robert Browning poem.
Right.
You know, which described it as just a squat dun tower, I think, or whatever, and it sounded decidedly boring and ugly in that, and I kind of wish he had diverged a little more from that, but oh well, you know.
But the imagery you came up with still works, because in this, Roland not looking at the literal tower, in this is right. The tower in his mind.
Yeah.
This is you know, Ahab and his whale, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's beautiful. I'm with you. I do like pointy bits on my towers, dark or light. Thank you very much.
Well, you know what? When I saw the British, there was a UK edition of the Gunslinger books where in the Gunslinger, you're pretty far away from the tower. And as you go through the books in the series, you get closer and closer to it. And there's all these really awesome details and texture and shit in the UK edition. I don't know who the illustrator was, but I looked at it and I said, man, I wish I'd done that, because it wasn't what King wrote, but it was right for the feeling of the story, and it just felt really, really cool to me. So I had a lot of envy for whoever did those.
Before we jump over to your work in book 7, you mentioned that Legends piece, which to me is the second key art image for me of what the Dark Tower is, because you got to incorporate the doorways, you got, you know, the Field of Roses, like all that stuff that's more when King and kind of more established what the Dark Tower was. In that. And it's also dynamic. And I'd love to talk to you about like how you portray a dynamic moment like that in a painting. Because you did that with Jake getting pulled by the slow mutants and the, you know, the flash of the muzzle, you know, in that piece, you know, whereas the Roland on the beach is a very still image, mm-hmm. you know, but I love that you can play in both worlds, and I'd love, you know, I guess some of it's in like Roland's got the semi cape thing going on that's flapping in the wind, and
yeah, I know.
It looks like he just threw open the door
ever in any of the books. King's never wearing a duster, but it seems like every artist who illustrates Roland just can't resist putting some kind of cloaky, dustery type of thing on the guy.
Right.
It feels right, but he never does have one in any of the books.
I guess King does talk about the bandana, right? He's got his red bandana.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, he's fairly drably dressed through most of the books, right? And I think he's just a no frills guy. You know, he's got his sandalwood grip guns and the holsters and
jeans. He's been traveling for thousands of years, so everything he's wearing is beat to shit. I have to say one thing about the hat, though. The hat I have a hat that I use as the model for whatever hat I ever show on him. And I got that hat from a girl I met at a Led Zeppelin concert at the Winterland back in the 70s. And we wanted to get up as close to the stage as we could. So we figured out if we crawled on our hands and knees through the crowd, that people would feel something bumping their feet and move aside for us. And we got right up to the stage, right in front of Robert Plant. And I was there with a good friend of mine and a girl that he met and her girlfriend. And, you know, we were digging the music. And she gave me the hat during the concert. And at some point we got separated and I never saw her again, but I still got the hat. So
holy shit.
That's where that came from.
Yeah. How was the show?
Oh, are you kidding?
I can't imagine.
It was awesome. Yeah, it was great.
I don't think I'll ever get to see Led Zeppelin perform. It's such a bummer. But
the song we were doing when we reached the stage was the Lemon song. That's the only part of that I remember. The rest of it.
Plus all the diseases you picked up by crawling on your hands and knees on that ground.
Can you
Worth it. That's a great strategy for getting to the stage.
Soup that must have been on the floor of that place.
So book seven, it's great thematically because they went out of their way to incorporate different artists throughout the entire series. But when you get to book seven, you realize it's going back to the first book anyway, right? So
Steve called me up and asked me about it, and you know, like, what am I going to say? No.
Right.
You know, and he said, there's a reason why I'm asking you to consider doing the artwork for the last book. And I said, well, okay, cool.
You didn't ask why? You just went with it?
Yeah. And he said, it'll become apparent to you when you get to read the manuscript. And I got to admit, the first thought that came to my head is, oh my God, I get to read these books before everybody else. And except for Ben Vincent, maybe. But, you know, I got the manuscripts for the last three books and I was in fucking heaven for a while, you know. And I got to read those and I said, oh, I see. You know, it all makes sense when you get to the ending of the seventh book, you know, that the Alpha and Omega part of it, you know, that. Mm-hmm. I was just so honored, you know, to be selected for that. And what can I say? You know, it was a film of practically, you know, half my life. So
right. And so you're a fan of the series going into this. Are you able to just enjoy the books as a fan, or are you going through going, I don't know, Phil Hale. I wouldn't have picked that moment to to illustrate if this was me.
This, you know what I mean? A cop out, but it's both at the same time.
Interesting.
I listen to the audiobooks on a pretty regular basis. I'd say at least once a year or maybe once every 2 years. And when I'm listening to that and picturing Phil Hale's illustration of something or Dave McKean's especially, I go, oh man, that's really wrong for this. You know, I would have done something completely different, but you know, right. So what, you know, I'm glad I didn't have to do all the books. It would have been too much fun.
Right. So I guess Wizard and Glass, because we've had this conversation between us, Wampler and I, and we did a bonus episode once about the various art in the various books. And I always thought that the Wizard in Glass art was like, it was the wrong book to take that kind of, you know, more abstracty approach to, because it is the most like rollicking, classical, romantic thing. And it's got, you know, a lot of high fantasy in it too. So is that like the book that if you could choose one that you didn't do, would it be Wizard in Glass, or would it be a different one?
Yeah, it'd be Wizard in Glass, I suppose. Though my favorite cover of the entire series is the Wizard in Glass cover. I love that fucking cover. The bullet in his teeth and the color changes on the cover and everything. I think it's just phenomenal. When I held that in my hands, I said, oh my God, this guy, whoever did this, nailed it. And I opened it up and saw it was him. And I've been a fan of his work for the Sandman comics for a long time. And that guy is a fucking genius. But that being said, there were some of the illustrations in there looked kind of dashed off to me. And I would have given them a different approach and blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm not here to put Dave McKean, but
no, of course not.
I mean, his cover though was fucking amazing. Just, oh God, I loved it. Even more so, one of my favorite books in the series is Wolves of the Kala. And I think that I would really love to have had a chance to do that. Every time I listen to the audiobook of Wolves of the Kala, I have a movie running in my head, and I see paintings, you know, running through my head the entire time that I wish I could paint and wish I had time in my life to realize as visual images that didn't get done, you know, for that book. So that's another one that stands out for me.
Wolves of the Kala has that sort of cinematic blockbuster pacing to it that Drawing of the Three has.
Yeah.
You know, where it's just like, when I think of those books, they're machines for entertainment. You know, there's things happening at precise intervals and beats, and it just keeps going until it's over. Like,
it pulls
you along. One thing I'm really curious about with the seventh book is that your original illustrations of Roland are not necessarily, there's not a how do I put this? Roland is a guy, right?
Yeah.
He's just a guy, like a cowboy in those images. In the seventh Dark Tower book, not only do you have an illustration of multiple Stephen Kings in there, but that illustration of Roland standing in front of the tower looks a lot like Stephen King. I have to assume that was intentional, right?
It's funny you should say that. I didn't intend for it to look a lot like Stephen King, but...
Really? Oh, yeah. Man, I can see him in that face completely.
Really? Wow. You know who I was thinking of? Maybe I shouldn't say this, but I was thinking of James Coburn.
There's some Coburn in there. Yeah.
The cheekbones. I see the cheekbones.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the problem is King can't fucking make up his own mind about what Roland looks like. In the Drawing of the Three, Jake walks by the movie theater and he looks at the poster and he sees Clint Eastwood. And he says, yeah, he looks like Roland, but then again, he doesn't. Well, thanks a lot, Steve. That doesn't tell me anything. You know? And then there's a scene in the seventh book where Roland goes down and he meets Stephen King. And there's some comment where he says he could be Roland's brother or whatever. Mm. There is a similarity, but then again, there isn't. And there are times when Eddie is looking at Roland during the Drawing of the Three, and he makes comments about, you know, how his face looks like it could have been carved out of granite, you know, so you figure all these sharp cheekbones and well-defined lines. And then Susanna says he could have the face of a poet, which is completely in a different direction. So, you know, King's description of Roland is never consistent in my view. So the one huge regret I have is that I actually put Roland's face in the light on the cover of the last book. I wish so much that I would put the sun on the other side of the picture and cast his face in shadows so that Every reader could kind of make up his own mind about what Roland really looks like. If there's anything I could do over again, it would be the cover of that last book. I regret trying to pin down a look for Roland and going with what I went with. And
I respect your take on that. At the same time, I'm also like,
everyone has a different idea of what Frodo looks like. And I think every artist is going to fail. Every artist, right. is going to fail with Roland, because you're going to pick and choose the elements of the story that you read, that you feel work with you and work with your experience and your feeling where the story's going. And you're going to have your own idea of what he looks like. And no artist is going to be able to capture that. So it's a fool's errand to try to come up with a definitive vision of what he looks like. So I can't believe that I let myself fall into that trap. But
oh well. I think it works as like the B side to the beach image with him sitting on the beach.
Yeah.
Right. Well, in that image, you can't see
what it is. And what's done is done, and it can't be undone. So too late for me now.
That's true, but I don't think you have anything to worry about. Like it's an iconic image, I think.
Well, when King told me he bought it and he put the picture up in his bedroom, I said, "Well, I couldn't be too far off if he felt that good about the depiction of him." But where the painting is now, I don't know. But several years ago, he had told me that, and I thought, well, okay, you know.
So you're Roland seeing some things that he dare not speak about, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's what you're saying. I guess so.
Here's the attitude that I feel looking at those images side by side. The beach image and the rose/tower image is, in the first one, Roland's face is hidden. He's dreaming of the tower. It's far off in the distance. Yeah. Now we get a nice long look at him in the sun, and he's looking at us like, guess what, motherfuckers? I made it. You know, it's such a good it's such a good dichotomy between those two images, and I love that about it.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to wrestle with, though. When you know, by the time the seventh book was done, you know, I felt I had so much responsibility hanging on my shoulders that to try to get things right, and I tried to just put all that aside and just let myself go crazy. I gave myself a period of months, and I said, I'm going to do anything. I'm going to work. I'm going to do some paintings in oils. I'm going to do some in acrylics. I'm going to do some pen and ink. I'm going to paint in black and white acrylics. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And I'm just going to give this pile of shit, this pile of artwork to Robert Wiener and let him do whatever he wants with it. I can't decide what's going to work and what isn't. And right. He did what he did with it. And, you know, I've got some issues with how the book ended up being designed and all that I'm not going to get into. But, you know, I didn't make the job easy for him because, you know, I gave him such an inconsistent mishmash of images to work with that I don't envy him his job of trying to put it all together and make it coherent.
How long did it take you to produce all the images for the final one?
My wife says I took 9 months, but I honestly don't have I'm not trying to duck the question, but it wasn't like I was keeping a diary or a journal and I said, oh, today I'm starting on
right.
Same thing. Book. I started reading the book, and my usual practice is that as I'm getting images in my head to turn over pages in the manuscript and do sketches, which later become the basis of concept pieces or black and white images that later become drawings, pen and ink drawings or paintings or whatever. It's just, I do remember trying to space out the color illustrations so that I don't have too many that focus on one particular part of the manuscript. I know when I read the scene where Mordred takes out the man in black that I had to paint that. And I had this image in my head of what it looked like. And my job was to exactly paint what was in my head. And if I did that, then I felt I nailed it, you know, and that sort of thing was going on in my mind also. So I'm sorry if I'm sounding kind of incoherent. I was kind of...
No, not at all.
Great.
The whole process was very, very subjective. I didn't take an objective or professional illustration attitude towards the assignment whatsoever. I went total fanboy on the thing.
What an awesome position to be in, though, you know, to be able to do that. Like, that's incredible.
It felt awesome. It really did.
The Crimson King is something that we have to talk about because that is, you talk about King being vague, like he's vague about the Crimson King up until the end.
Yeah, he sure is.
Your image of the Crimson King, you know, not to put King down at all, but like to me, like there, he's more imposing and more of like intriguing in that image than I think he ever ended up playing out as in the story.
I know. And
I love the end of the Dark Tower. But even me, I'm, you know, as you know, starting a Stephen King podcast, I love the circular nature. I love the very end of the tower, but even me, I still sit back and go, well, maybe you shouldn't have just introduced a character in the last book that can just erase the big bad guy. You know, it's like, you know, I still had that moment, but so maybe you can talk a little bit about your approach to the Crimson King, who's been kind of introduced as this, like, overall, he's like the Sauron of this story that no matter how it plays out, like this is the thing that's been hanging over Roland's journey for at least half of the books at this point. You know, how do you approach that?
You know, when I painted him on his throne, that's the kind of gravity that I wish he continued to have for the rest of the book.
Right.
I was fulfilling my own wish right there. But when I got to the point where, he's just erased away, it was kind of a letdown, I guess, for me. I don't know how King could have painted himself out of that corner, but I wish there had been some other way that, you know, because he's like the ultimate badass person in the universe, and but I felt that way about Mordred and the Men in Black too,
right?
You know, though the scene where he meets his demise is one of the most horrific things I've ever read in my life. It's
right.
Oh my God. Sends a shiver up my spine just thinking about it, but still, he's such an imposing figure, you know, throughout and in his various incarnations as Flag or whatever, and to, I don't know, to have him be just thrown away like a Kleenex kind of in
right.
After was disappointing.
On the one hand, it's fitting because Flag always overestimates himself.
Yeah.
You know, that's typical of Flag.
Right.
But on the other hand, I do see the angle of like, it's Flag. Like, he shouldn't just go out like that. Like, that's, you know, it's over in an instant. And as horrifying as the scene. Yeah.
Some kind of battle royal, you know, of some sort, you know.
Yeah. But I think that's just the truth in the middle of those two ideas is that that's what that scene is there to communicate, that that's how powerful Mordred is.
Yeah.
But then I guess Mordred gets, you know, taken out next to a campfire, you know?
right. Yeah.
But I do love that Crimson King image. And I think in Insomnia, like young Patrick Danville, like envisions the Crimson King as, and like mentions him looking like a catfish or something fucking crazy. Am I imagining
really?
That?
I don't remember that.
Yeah. It's, I would have to go back and look at it, and I don't actually have a copy of Insomnia right now, but...
Wow, I've got to go back and refer to my copy. It's been years since I've read that, so...
Yeah, me too. And I may be, like, completely misremembering that, but that idea always stuck with me, so I was thinking, oh, so the Crimson King isn't even, like, human. It's, like, something else entirely. It's a creature.
Yeah.
But now it's just a guy shrieking on a balcony. Apparently.
So I love the image of his eyes just floating there, and
right,
you know, that I saw that in the movie in my mind, and how horrible that was and appropriate and everything, but it's a strange denouement. left very mixed feelings in my head, in my mind. Right.
But also,
I kept telling myself, this is Steve's book, not my book. He's not writing it.
Right. Right. And a friend of mine always says, like, I have sympathy for fiction writers having to write an ending. Like, you got to write an ending. There's no choice. And sometimes it's just, you know, it's never going to match whatever people in their heads are imagining. So you're up against that. And then, you know, sometimes you need it to just work out cleanly. And I think that's what's going on there.
Thematically, too, like, because in my mind, you know, and this is like putting me in the people who are upset that Luke Skywalker didn't, you know, jump around and destroy all those, you know, Imperial walkers and shit in Last Jedi. Because in my mind, I'm like, I wanted to see the Quartet all together storming the Dark Tower. That's kind of what I wanted to see. Wow. But like, I appreciate that Roland in that last book is losing every piece of himself.
Right.
Yeah. And
right.
That is what it takes to get to his ultimate goal. And that's been established since book one when he let Jake fall. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, there is a cleanness to Roland being the last one there. And so I'll always appreciate it, you know, thematically, even though it's not exactly what I wanted to see, you know, happen. I think that's, you know, you got to look at, you know, what makes sense for the story. Just as I think Rian Johnson looked at Last Jedi and said, what makes sense for the story that I've been set up for. Not to to enrage the Star Wars fan base against us any more than they are already, but you know, but I do appreciate when an artist takes a swing like that and chooses what's better for the story than, you know, just writing whatever they think the fans might want to see.
Yeah, fan service versus keeping your truth and integrity as an artist. So
right,
but man, it's hard because so much of my job as an illustrator for what the 40 odd years I've been working has been, a lot of it's been fan service. Right. When you think
by
about
definition,
it, I'm trying to visualize what's in my head and satisfy myself as a fan and a reader, but also the author, the readers, the marketing people for the publishing company, the editors. I don't envy being in a position of trying to wind that series up. Oh my God.
Right.
It's so hard. But at the same time, I had a feeling when I got to the end of it that I shouldn't get into it. I'm trying to read Steve's mind and that's not fair to him. So.
Right.
I think overall he hit the exact right note. It needed to end on that circular note, and anything that happens before that, you know, in that 100 pages or so before we get to the idea that all of this is repeating.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he had a monumental task before him. And if the alternative was, I don't know, an extra 100 pages or so where Roland battles the fucking Crimson King from that field of roses up to his little porch on the tower, would that have made me more happy? I don't think so. So,
right.
You know, I'm fine with it. I'm fine with it now. One thing I would like to touch on here is that largely because we mentioned this before, but there's an image in the seventh book with Father Callahan, and he's holding up the turtle and in the Dixie pig with all
Dixie
the
pig, yeah.
Yeah. And I think here's my theory. I think this is your mirror image version of the Roland with the slow mutants picture from the first book. You have two primary lighting sources here, just like you did in the first book, the glowing mutants plus the gun going off. Here it's the light flooding in from the outside of that private room plus the amulet. Was that intentional, or am I just drawing connections
not
based on light sources?
At all. It never occurred to me until you mentioned it just now, but I saw there being a lot of light sources because there were candles or what he calls flambeaux around the room and on the tables, and there was light in the room where the elder vampires were when they come in through the tapestry. And no, I didn't think of the two as being parallel at all.
There's another parallel that you can see, at least in the color scheme, and it's one of the most haunting images that you've ever put in any of the Dark Tower books, and that is when Roland is carrying Jake through the trees.
Oh yeah.
And like, listen, I was crying already by this point, And then you son of a bitch, I turn that page and see that. And I'm just like, I had to shut the book, it is a very sad image, but it also reminds me a little bit of the melancholy feeling from, the gunslinger, of the illustration of him sitting at the ruins or whatever, at the riverbank. And both are very green and lush and calm in a way. One's more, one's sadder, of course, but I can definitely see that being, a complimentary piece to that piece.
Yeah. I didn't think of one while I was doing the other, but I could see where there's a comparison. Yeah. But yeah, that scene was so, so heavy. And again, I felt my jaw was just to paint the way I saw it in my head when I was reading that scene. And God, that's just an amazing piece of writing. It just floored me.
Indeed.
Before we wrap up, I'd love to touch on perspective, because you mentioned multiple times that you see a movie playing in your head. So when you pick an image, you are picking a camera angle, kind of almost, right?
Yeah.
You do that very well, throughout your work, obviously. But if we're focusing on Dark Tower, I remember the hanging man in Gunslinger, has that kind of extreme overhead, shot. So is that how you pick your perspective? Is you just take a frame from the movie in your head? Is that
pretty much so? Yeah, it wasn't like I knew I wanted to have Cuthbert and Roland in the scene with the bread, leaving the crumbs and everything.
You're right.
Yeah, I can't explain how that came into my head from that angle. It's just how I saw that scene. And I remember the painting came fairly easily to me.
It's beautiful. And all the work that you've done throughout the Dark Tower series has, once again, not only made an impression on me, but has solidified what those stories are in my mind.
Oh, thanks a lot.
And I can't thank you enough for that. I can't thank you enough for actually letting me kind of wrap my head around what Oi actually looks like.
Oh yeah. there's ride. And in some instances, with things that keep coming back to me, every once in a while, I'll get an Elric book or a Dark Tower book to do or something. I find sometimes that my vision of something will change, just like Walt Disney's vision of what Mickey Mouse changed over the decade. Mm-hmm. And he redefined it. And my feeling of Oi has been fairly consistent, but I'm pretty convinced that King sees him as having more of a curly tail than I give him. But aside from that, I tried to stay as close to King's description of him as possible.
You know what's funny is only on one of my more, I reread the Dark Tower books every couple of years. And only on my last reread, for whatever reason, did I pick up on the idea that Oi has I think he describes him as like a UK footballer's accent,
Right. Yeah.
I don't know how, cause I've read these books so many goddamn times, but I just didn't absorb that. And this time when I got to it, I was like, was this detail always there? I didn't realize like Oi sounded like Vinnie Jones or some shit,
Yeah.
It's interesting. And I don't know. And to be fair, I've also always struggled with how Oi must actually look. Sometimes it's more of a raccoon. Sometimes it's more of a dog. Sometimes it's,
I know. But he varies his description quite a bit. And there's raccoons, badgers, dachshunds, corgis. he references a lot of different animals, and badgers. So you're trying to, as an artist, you're trying to incorporate what you think are the most relevant. I like the idea of him being striped. So, I take that from a badger, and he's got to have those really soulful golden eyes. And are his ears going to be round like on a raccoon, or pointy like on a corgi, or whatever, But look, that's kind of makes it fun, So every artist has his different take on what Oi looks like. But I know what mine looks like.
Since you're so ingrained in this Dark Tower feeling if somebody were to ever like actually get to make this for real, would you be interested in like joining the art department for them? Kind of like how Alan Lee did with Peter Jackson and Lord of the Rings, because I can't.
They did the Gunslinger movie with Idris Elba. All they asked me about using was my symbol for Ka, Ka symbol. They wanted to put that somewhere in the background. And I said, that's it. That's the only part of my and I said, okay, give me X number of dollars and you'll have the right to use that and blah, blah, blah. But when I saw the movie, I was just as happy that that's the part I had to do with it. But, I don't know. I've worked on a couple of movie projects in the past, and it's really not a very fun experience. So much of what you do ends up on the floor, on the editing room floor, or ends up not being used, or the whole project gets shit canned, and all that work. They always want to buy all rights, so you can't show it anywhere. You don't even have ownership of your own work.
Right.
Where's the fun in that? Plus, you have the situation where you're showing the work to money guys and producers and people who in my opinion don't have much of an artistic sensibility, and they're making crucial decisions about how something's going to look or something's going to feel, and they're the wrong people to be to making those decisions. So it's not very, very fun. So my whole thing has been about enjoying what I'm doing and having fun with. So I only work with people that I enjoy working with, and I work on projects that I feel committed to on all kinds of different levels. And if there's something in a book that involves father-daughter incest or something like that, I'm not going to have anything to do with it.
Right.
I've been very fortunate to be able to make those kind of decisions and stick to them and be happy with everything I'm doing. So that would factor in a lot with, if there was a movie or a project coming along that I would have to speak to the people and feel like we had some kind of common ground and common vision before I would agree to have anything to do with it.
Just from a fan perspective, I think that would be the smart way to go about it, because I think one of the undersung aspects of what Peter Jackson did with Lord of the Rings was bringing on John Howe and Alan Lee.
Absolutely.
Those movies would not. The people, the designers at Weta are some of the most imaginative, brilliant people, but there's something to bringing in the illustrators that have lived within these worlds forever that can just tell you what this looks like, because they pictured it for decades.
I agree more. When I heard that Alan Lee was in on the project, I knew the movies were going to be awesome.
Yeah. I spent some time on those sets and in the sets of The Hobbit, and I didn't get to know him well, but I got to know Alan and John a little bit, and they very kindly both like drew me little illustrations in my book. So those are like treasured things. I'll keep forever. I got a Gollum from one and a Gandalf from the other. So
you couldn't have picked better artists to have involved in the project, and it affected the whole look of the thing. Yeah, it was
right.
That was a complete validation of your point right there.
So if good people do Dark Tower, they can come to you and maybe it'll work out, is what I'm saying.
well, thank you. A movie of Black House. I want in on that. I love that book, and it's scary as shit and freaky as shit. And I love the freaky aspects of it. And I heard that there's a talisman in the works. So if that leads to Black House, I'd really love to get my foot in that door, man.
All right. So the Duffers, if you're listening, Steven Spielberg, if I know you're a Patreon subscriber, so, feel free to hit up our boy Michael here.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, we're probably getting to the same point. I was going to say, this is usually the point where we, allow our guests to tease or pitch whatever they've got going on right now. And your website, very much in operation. You're selling prints right now. Are you selling Dark Tower prints right now?
Yeah.
I confess I have not looked this morning.
Selling them all the time. And in fact, what I've been doing the last day and a half is trying to fix the goddamn printer. prints the things. When I sign the prints, it's because I ran the damn thing off and approved it. So,
nice.
You know, occasionally I'll do a remark or a sketch on a print, but you know, I try not to do it too often because it involves time, you know, and I've only got so many hours per day. But anyway, I hope I can get the thing fixed. But I don't. You know, because I've listened to some of your podcasts, I realize you come to a point where guests can plug things, and I've got nothing to plug.
Well, you got your store.
The last 6 months is getting to a point where I've got nothing on my horizon, so I could do my gallery work for a year, and that's right where I'm at. I'm just about done with a few little projects I've had to get out of the way, and then I've got some open horizon in front of me, and I'm so hyped. I'm so psyched. Nice. I can't tell you, but it doesn't mean that at some point it could be Halloween this year or something. I'll say, you know what? I've got to do this image from the mist that I've always wanted to paint, and it'll be another Stephen King related thing, but it'll be generated by me, from me, because I'm into it and want to do it, not because I've been hired to do it. And that's a wonderful place to be. It's, believe me, I realize how rare it is for an artist to make a living, and to make moreover to make a living being an artist, and to put your kids through Ivy League colleges and to have a nice house and all that kind of stuff. It's extremely rare. And so there isn't a day where I'm not cognizant of how privileged and lucky I am a person. And part of that is because people like Stephen King have took a liking to my work and tapped me to do things in association with them and ride a little bit on the gravy train that he represents. And so fortunate and grateful for how that's worked out. And so it's been a wonderful life, and I've had a wonderful opportunity. And so I'm not going to plug anything.
Right on.
We'll do it for you. You
enjoyed my work and supported me all these years.
I definitely want people to know that they can pick up these Dark Tower prints at it's michaelwhalen.com, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Very easy. Go to the store there. You know, I can vouch for the Gunslinger on the Beach. As I said, I look at it every single day. And the one thing that I'll always kick myself for is I think your the Legends piece went out of print, and I never got that one. So
yeah.
So there's something I can chase on the secondary market for the rest of my days.
Okay.
Everybody should go check out the website, even just to look at your art, you know, the beautiful stuff that you have up there and all the stories behind it. So thank you so much for joining us. This has been a blast.
Can I say one other thing?
Sure.
If you ever devote a podcast to audiobooks, I want in. I want fucking in, because I've got I love a lot of the King's audiobooks. I love the readers, I mean the good ones, and I've got definite opinions about them. And I would love to be in on that conversation. So just keep me in mind. Okay. That's all.
Absolutely.
For sure. Yeah. No, the audiobooks have been a huge help for me as I've been going through this, because I'm a very slow reader. So it's actually quicker for me to revisit a lot of these King stories via audiobook as we're recording these episodes. Because some of these things that we're talking about, I haven't read since, you know, I was 20 years old.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm wanting to be kind of caught up on it.
It adds such a dimension to a book. And these days, I don't communicate much with Steve. We email once in a while back and forth. But 9 times out of 10, it's about audiobooks. And I'm telling him that, you know, Will Patton just aced that fucking Paul Givney character whatever. And I love sharing that with him and hearing his enthusiasm about it too. It's just really
cool. That's awesome.
Did you hear the version of It read by Steven Weber? That one was excellent.
Yeah. Well, my current favorite is The Life of Chuck, that this guy named Danny Bernstein, who I've never heard of before. I think he fucking nails that. It's I've listened to that probably 20 times.
Oh, wow.
It's like listening to music for me, you know.
Interesting.
The nuance, the parts of the story that even though I read it, I didn't catch, but I catch it in the audiobook because he adds a particular nuance to it or whatever. And anyway, I don't want to beat it in dead horse, go over it and over and over.
No,
yeah, we have long.
So I'd really like to be in on it.
We have long had requests for a bonus episode devoted entirely to the audiobooks. And if you're listening to these things 20 times a piece, it sounds like you are very qualified to be the guest on that particular episode when we do it.
Yeah. We'll talk off mic. We'll kick around some ideas.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us.
This
has been a pleasure.
And yes, this was amazing.
Many thanks to Mr. Whalen and, of course, to you all for joining me in this look back in the KingCast archives. Next week, we have a brand new episode for you. And if you want to catch up on the reading in advance, I will tell you that the title is Mrs. Todd's Shortcut, which is a very sticky short story that can be found in Skeleton Crew. It's one of those that kind of deals with the world right next to our own. Maybe thinnies are in play here. You don't know. There could be monsters. There could be alternate dimensions. All we know is that Mrs. Todd does love her shortcuts, and she seems to be making road trips much quicker than she should be. And then this Friday on our Patreon, I'll be joined by Gen Z horror blogger, Fango contributor, and filmmaker Gory Corey to talk about another King short story. They all kind of rhymes. Gory Corey talking about a King short story. The short story in question is The Monkey, which I'm sure is going to be a rowdy conversation, because not only do we get to talk about one of King's best short stories, but also we get to daydream a little bit about what the hell this Osgood Perkins adaptation that's in the can and coming out early next year is going to be like. So to get access to that and 4+ years worth of bonus episodes, make sure to sign up over at patreon.com/thekingcast. And that should be that. So thanks for listening, and adios, folks. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abby Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.